like to welcome Mike G. from Santa Monica.
Jersey Mike, I'm an alcoholic. There you go, Sunday morning. My sobriety date is September 24th, 1991. My home group is the 3720 Knuckleheads Men's Meeting of Venice. It is the best home group ever, and if you don't think your home group is the best home group ever, then you need to go find a new one. I want to thank Brent for asking me to come out here and the rest of everybody else. You know, I guess I always like to start with this one story. I started drinking at a really, really young age. So at 3 years old, bear with me here. At 3 years old, my parents were having a barbecue. Everybody was out, and they're drinking beers, and they're drinking wine. And my uncle thought it would be funny to hand me a sip of his beer. And he hands me a sip of his beer, and apparently I go ballistic after this. And I won't leave him alone. And he kind of shooes me away and gives me a kick in the butt and sends me on my way. And he says he watches me go from person to person throughout the whole barbecue and take, you know, and get a sip of their beer. So an hour goes by and the manhunt's on for me because they can't find me. And, it takes them a while, but my mother looks over at a fence at the neighbor's yard in the sandbox and finds me with a bucket over my head. This is the foreshadowing of my life. I never drank like a human being, ever. I grew up in New Jersey, about 6 miles outside of Philadelphia, about 4 miles outside of Camden, New Jersey, in a little town called Maple Shade. It was best known in the 50s as in the Guinness Book of World Records for most bars per square mile in the world. And it was a nice Irish-Italian, Catholic, blue-collar, Sopranos kind of town, you know, and it was one of those towns where, you know, there was always a barbecue, there was always a party, there was always something going on, you know, and I grew up in this town, and I'm 43 years old, I guess everyone else is 23, I'm 43, so I grew up in the 70s, and in the 70s, divorce became very popular, and my parents got divorced like everybody else's parents in the fucking world, and I didn't take it well. I was a very angry, angry kid. You know, I was angry, I was miserable, I was fearful, I was everything that, you know, that we like to say, you know, an alcoholic is. I grew up fist fighting, I grew up beer drinking, pot smoking, I grew up snorting cocaine, I grew up shooting up heroin, I grew up doing all those fun things that we like to do, you know. I was angry, I was miserable, I was selfish, I was self-centered, and none of this made me the alcoholic, you know. It just helped fuel it, you know. It fueled it like there was no tomorrow. In seventh grade, I was like 12 years old, and they gave a test to every kid in the state of New Jersey, and they were starting these special schools for kids that, you know, got in the top 10% of this test, and they came to my school, and, you know, I put in the top 5% of these people, of these kids in the state of New Jersey for this new special school they were going to put all these kids in, and they showed up to my school to see me, to interview me, hair down to here, I'm high as a kite, and I'm failing every class I'm in. And they looked at me, and they just kind of shook their head and went, "We can't do anything with you," you know? And it became a recurring theme in my life, you know? I wasn't a happy-go-lucky drunk, you know? I was that guy I was that kid that showed up at your house party, and you went, "Fuck," you know? How do we get rid of him? I was the guy that showed up in your house and I stole everything that was in it. You know, I was not that, you know, happy, you know, have a few drinks, this is a blast, this is great. I was have a few drinks, blackout, throw a punch at somebody bigger than me and wind up in the hospital kind of drunk. You know, My drinking is probably just like everybody else's in here. You know, I picked that first one up and I couldn't stop. My drinking career spanned really probably from about 12 years old to about 23 years old. And in that time period, in that short little span of life, I caused more damage and more wreckage than I could ever have imagined I could have. You know, I can tell you about, you know, my first drink, you know, at 3 years old. I'll tell you about my last bit of drinking at age 23. At age 22, I had three children. I didn't know where any of them were. They were from three different moms. And at 22 years old, I was living in the streets of Hollywood. I was drinking cheap vodka. I was sleeping in alleyways. I was eating out of dumpsters. I heard the girl last night who was speaking, talking about mainlining alcohol. You know, and I laughed when she said it because I'm sick and twisted. You know, but that's beside the point. I laughed when she said it because I remember I was hanging with a bunch of runaways. I was 22 years old, and we're up in the streets in Hollywood, and we couldn't get any coke, meth, or freaking heroin that night. But we had whiskey. And this is the processing of my mind by age 22. And this is that sick and twisted, demented thing that alcoholism does to us. I said to myself, well, you know, I used to do coke, I snorted coke, and it was great for a while, and then I smoked coke, and it got better, and then I shot up coke, and it got really good, you know? I only drink alcohol. Maybe I should shoot it up, you know? And that's the sick, twisted version of my brain by age 22. You know, it said to me that this was a good idea. You know, it didn't say to me, go home, clean up, get a job, pay your child support, raise your kids, you know, pay back all that money you stole off your family, you know, and turn yourself in for the bench warrants. You know, it said, shoot up this freaking Jack Daniels right now. You know, and that's the point I got to very quickly. You know, I didn't have that, you know, there was a fun time when I did drinking and drugs, and then it kind of got worse. It was worse right from the fucking beginning, man. You know, I drank alcoholically. I picked up a drink, and the obsession and that craving was there immediately. Because that's what alcoholism is, they told me. You know, it's not the lying, the cheating, the stealing. You know, it's picking up a drink, putting it to your lips, and not being able to, you know, make a sane decision afterwards. You know, and I was not able to make sane decisions. I was 15 years old. It was October 1983 when my buddy had stole a car and we put a case of beer in the back seat. And at 15 years old, drunk, we weren't very good drivers, and we wound up kind of like half on a pole and half in a pond. And the judge didn't find this amusing, and I wound up in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at 15 years old. And in 1983, there wasn't a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm 15, and I walk in the door, and I was down in this basement in a town called Morristown, New Jersey, and this 200-year-old church, and they're smoking down there, and there's like a layer of frickin' smoke, you know. You can see people's kneecaps, and that's about it, man. And I walk in there, and they're like, can we help you with something, kid? And I go, yeah, judge told me I got to do AA, you know. And he's like, oh, well, you know. They're like, all right, what do we do with you? You're like 15, you know. And they're like, well, why don't you go talk to the other young guy over there? And I'm like, all right. And I go walking over, and there's this dude standing there. And I go, hey, I'm looking for some young guy, you know, whatever his name was. And he goes, yeah, that's me. He was like 35 years old, you know. And he was like my dad's age. And I'm like, great, this is going to be like this, huh? And I sat in the back of the room, and I listened to these guys talk about the craving and of alcoholism. And I heard them talk about losing their wife, you know. And this guy's like, I've lost my house, my wife, my bank account, my kids. And I'm thinking, I'm 15 years old. I haven't had that fun yet, you know. And I left that meeting, and I learned real quickly that when you have a court card, people sign it with just their first name and an initial. And I went, oh. And I went to school and I said, sign your first name and initial. You know? And I, you know, and that's that alcoholic thinking, isn't it? And that was my first bit of Alcoholics Anonymous. I compared what everybody was going through. You know, I compared. I said, you know, that's not me. That's not me. You know, and I spent the next, what, 7 to 8 years bouncing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, bouncing in and out of hospitals. You know, I used to get high on the steps at his Narcotics Anonymous meeting. You know, it was you know, and asked everybody if they wanted to hit when they were going by, you know. And that's what kind of guy I was. Real stand up. And at age 22, I found myself on a Greyhound bus escaping Los Angeles to go back to New Jersey. When I say escaping, it's because I pissed off a lot of people, and all of a sudden somebody wanted to hurt me really bad. And I called up my foster mom, and I said, I gotta get the fuck out of here really quick. She's like, all right, I'm gonna wire you some money. You get to LAX, you take a plane, and you come home. I said, great, great, I'll do that. She wired me $300, and I grabbed $300, and I got $300 in my hand, and it was enough to buy a ticket back to you know, Jersey. And I said to myself, well, for, you know, $59, I can get on a Greyhound, you know. And I had all the best intentions. I buy the Greyhound ticket, and I buy three bottles of some kind of schnapps, and I buy all these Valiums because I'm about to kick heroin on a bus, and on a 3-day, 72-hour bus trip cross country. And again, same thinking, you know. And I get on this bus, and I get to somewhere outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I'm hurting, you know. The schnapps ain't doing it for me anymore, you know, and my body's hurting, and I'm detoxing. And we're at this rest stop in the middle of nowhere, and I get off the bus, and I go into the bathroom, and here's the ugly part of this, and I'm in a stall, and I can't stop getting sick, you know. And well, the reality of it is, I'm shitting myself, I'm pissing myself, and I'm puking my brains out because I'm detoxing. And I'm in a stall in the middle of New Mexico, in the middle of nowhere, and the bus driver comes out. I had a duffel bag, and he throws the duffel bag at me and said, "The next bus comes in 12 hours." He goes, "I'll call him and let him know you're here." And I detoxed in a stall in the middle of nowhere, Albuquerque, thinking, it can't get any lower than this, can it? You know? And the next bus comes, and I make it back to New Jersey, and the whole way back, I'm like, I'm popping Valiums to try to keep myself down. And I get back, and I get to my foster mom's house, and I say to myself, this is it. I can't do this anymore. You know? I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm done. You know? No more drugs. This is it, man. I can't live like this anymore. And I get back to the house, and my foster mom's there, and it's midnight, and she's like, listen, go take a shower, here's $20, go down to the convenience store, go get yourself a sandwich, and just get yourself together, because you look like fucking shit. Alright, I'll do it. And I get in the shower, and the whole time my brain's telling me, you're not going to do this anymore, you're done, you're absolutely done. And I get in the shower, and I get out, and the $20 is there, and I take the $20, and I walk out the front door, and got to turn right to get to the Wawa convenience store, you know, and you turn left to get to Alden Cafe bar, and I was beyond any kind of thought process that would allow me to turn right. I had the $20 in my hand, and I turned left, and I said, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. And I walked into the bar, and everybody's like, Mike, you're back, hey, and they start buying drinks, and I'm drinking, and I'm going, just one. And I took that first one, and I blacked out. And I woke up the next morning, and I went on a run. And I can't tell you how long it lasted. I did a lot of blackout stuff, and it was only a few months, and I'm sleeping in the laundry room of this beat-up old building, I come out, and my buddy's parked out there, and this is a guy I've known for many, many years, and he says to me, what are you doing? You know, what's going on, man? And I said, I'm hurting, man, I'm hurting. And he's like, you know, well, come back to my house, you know, and he goes, I'm sober now. I said, great. And he took me back to his house, and I had to detox again, and I used to tell the story as this, you know. I detoxed in his spare room, and, you know, it was awful, but it was okay. What happened was he threw a sleeper sofa in his garage and said, I'll see you in 3 days. You know, and I detoxed. And I somehow or another, I got 3 days of clean and sober, and I was working as a busboy. I was 23 years old, and I was working as a busboy at this place that had a bar in it and a restaurant, and I went back into work that day, and there's this girl there, and I was 23, she was probably about 18, and she was beautiful, and she used to come to me all the time, and every time she'd see me, she'd be like, so, what did you do last night? And I'd tell her, and she'd be like, thank you, and walk away. And I walked in, and she'd do this to me all the time, and she wouldn't talk to me any other way. And I walk in, and I guess I had a little bit of color in my face, and she said, what's going on with you? You look different today. I said, I quit drinking, I'm done, you know, no more. And she said, great, what are you doing about it? I said, I'm just not going to do it anymore. And she said, no, really, really, what are you going to do about it? And we did that dance, you know, you do, and you're trying to. And she says, listen, I've been sober for a year, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight, would you like to go? Just because you don't have a drink in you, you don't think straight, I'm telling you sometimes. All I heard was this 19-year-old blonde-haired, brown-eyed girl to say, hey, you want to go out tonight? So, all smiles, yeah. You know, and I went, and she took me to this place called the ODAC Club, One Day at a Time Club, and it was in Mount Holly, New Jersey. And Mount Holly, New Jersey is one of the most pleasant of places in the world, and it was at this really old church, and the church you could see through the slats outside, and the bathroom was down in the basement, but you had to kick the rats out of the way, you know, and the whole time you're in this meeting, you know, you know drunks are coming in and out, you know, like off the street, you know, just to get a coffee and a free cigarette, you know, and I'm sitting in this meeting, and I thought, this is the end, this is what it's come to. I'm 23 fucking years old, and I'm sitting in an old church on a Saturday night with a bunch of smelly old drunks, and I realize, it's me, you know? And I spent 4 months dry. I'd like to say I was clean and sober, but all I could tell you is that people would pick me up and take me to meetings, and I wasn't very coherent, and I wasn't doing any step work, and I was going to the dances, and I was doing all the young people stuff, and I wasn't really paying attention to what was going on, man. I just knew that people were feeding me, giving me cigarettes, and like, I had free coffee supply, you know. And I had no defense against the first drink. And everybody kept telling me, get a sponsor, Mike. I'm like, I'm all right, man. I'm going to meetings. You know, it's cool. I'm going to meetings, man. They're like, get a sponsor. Work. No. I got it. I go to a set meeting. They're like, can you even read? You know? And at 4 months, I had no defense against that first drink. And I'm working as a cook in a bar restaurant. And I had a bad day at work. The workday night ends, and I go out, and this waitress was going to give me a ride home, but she said, it's going to take me another hour, and I said, okay, I just sat at the bar, and I had no defense against the first drink, because all I did was go to meetings, you know, and I drank. No, willpower alone wasn't going to save me. I drank, and I blacked out a lot, and I blacked out, and I woke up the next morning, and I can't breathe. Whole left side of me is bruised from here up, and I can't breathe. And the guy I'd been living with, who was sober, you know, is just looking at me in disgust. You know, like everybody looks at you when you go back out. You know that? Oh God, man. You know? And I said, I got to get to the hospital. He's like, fuck you, do whatever you do. You know? And I jump on the motorcycle and I get to the hospital, and it's like Sunday morning early, and I get to the emergency room, and I'm an alcoholic, you know, so I like grand entrances, so I go through the ambulance driver's door, it slides open, I got my helmet on, I take the helmet off, and I go to say help, and I collapse. I wake up, I'm on this table, and they got this x-ray machine on me, and they say, your lungs collapsed. What happened? I don't know. They say to me, did you get hit by a car? I said, I don't know. Did you get into a fight? I don't know. Okay. They're like, we got to do a quick surgery, and we're going to put a tube in you. You know, I'm going to shoot you up with morphine. He goes, I'll be back in 5 minutes, and we'll just do this. I said, great. Shoots me up with morphine. He walks out the door, and he comes back in with these knives, and I go, whoa. I said, no, the morphine hasn't kicked in. He goes, that morphine should have kicked in already. He goes, let me give you another shot. He gives me another shot, and he goes, we'll be back in 5 minutes, and he comes back in, and he's like, you ready? I go, no. Are you a drug addict, kid? I said, yes, and everything changed. The look on his face became that of disgust. The rubber gloves went on. He went outside to tell everybody else. He said, you know, he goes, this kid's a drug addict. You know, he's an intravenous drug user and an alcoholic. And they all came back in, the nurses, and they were putting rubber gloves on me and looking at me like, oh, shit, you know. And the doctor comes back in the room and says, legally, I can't give you another shot of morphine. He goes, but I think you know what to do. And he puts the stuff there and he walks out of the room and I give myself, you know, the shot of morphine. And he comes back in with like six other doctors. But I could hear him out in the hallway and he's got these other doctors there. He goes, this kid weighs about 125 pounds and we just gave him 3 shots of morphine, enough to drop a gorilla. He goes, you want to see what drug addiction and alcoholism does? Come here. And all of a sudden, I became a sideshow. And that incomprehensible demoralization that comes along with going back out hit me. And it hit me hard. And they do the surgery and they keep me on morphine for a while because they put like a garden hose into your chest and it hurts like hell. And I'm in there and I want to go to an AA meeting and I know there's a detox in this hospital and I just want to go to the AA meeting there. Can they get me there? No, they'll send somebody up from the detox, and the detox guy was nuts. You know, he's sitting there yelling at me going, you're going to die, you're going to die. And I'm like, yeah, get out. You know, so I started making phone calls to people in Alcoholics Anonymous and they started showing up and they were bringing AA meetings to me in the hospital. And I thought, these are the only people that want to be around me. You know, this is it. This is it. I got nowhere else left to go, man. You know, even the bars I'm not allowed into anymore. And I spend like a week in the hospital, and the doctor. So I'm getting out of the hospital, and the doctor is writing a prescription for like Percodan, and I'm like, woohoo, you know, and he's writing this prescription, and my mother walks in the door, and I hadn't seen my mother in like 3 years. And she walks in, she looks at me, and she looks at the doctor, she looks over his shoulder, and says, you can't give that to him, he's a drug addict. And the doctor crumples up the paper, throws it in the trash, and says, take some Tylenol, kid, you'll be all right. If you're anything like me, and anger's an issue, let's just say an hour and a half after the hospital, I'm drinking. Because I have no defense against that first drink. I go back home to my house. My buddy who I've been living with had pins and needles and all these things in his knees from a knee surgery from like 2 weeks before. And he was popping Percodan and smoking weed. And his girlfriend had just left him that night before while I was in the hospital. And it was a recipe for disaster. And I can tell you this. I got a patch over my chest, a hole. I'm smoking cigarettes. I'm about to take my last drink in a bowling alley. I wish my story was like, you know, incredible for my last drink, but I'm in a bowling alley, and I'm starting a fight at a pool table with these three big guys. I got a patch over my chest. I'm sideways like this because I can't stand up straight, and I got a beer in my hand, a cigarette hanging out of my mouth, and I'm starting a fight over a quarter on a pool table. You know, that's how I drink. My buddy comes hobbling over like, you know, like he's going to help, you know. And these guys just throw a dollar down and they're just disgusted at me and they just walk away, you know. And it was like my life story, you know, you're disgusted at me and you walk away. We sat down at the bar, and this is my last drink right here. My buddy and I, Camden, New Jersey is where you get all your drugs if you're around that area and you want to go back out and use, that's the place to go. So, he looks at me and he says, you know, let's do some coke. Let's go to Camden. I said, yeah, let's do it, man. And we clink our beers together and I down mine. I put mine down first. 2 seconds later, he puts his down. And we get into his Volkswagen and you gotta kind of turn left to go to Camden, turn right to go home. And I call this divine intervention because somehow or another that car turned right. I woke up the next morning at home. I didn't go to Camden, and I came out into the kitchen, and the phone's right next to the refrigerator. And I opened up the refrigerator, and it was like 3 beers left in the back. And my mind's going, you can drink that. But if you drink them, this is the bitter end they talk about. And then I looked at the phone, and they said, hey, it's just going through my head, you know, all those stupid things everybody says. And that saying, you know, Mike, and it says, my head says this, Mike, you know, if you call somebody first before you drink, they can help you. But if I drink those beers and then call them, they can't do anything for me. And I battled this for 10 minutes, looking at the beers, looking at the phone, looking at the beers. So again, my great conniving way, I say, I'm going to call somebody. I pick up the phone and I call somebody who I know is at work because I know their schedule. And I dial the phone and I'm waiting for the voicemail to pick up and I hear, hello. And I'm thinking, fuck, you know. And apparently I said that out loud and I hear, Mike, is that you? I go, yeah. It was my friend Teresa from work, and she says, you drank again, didn't you? And I said, yes, I did drink again. And she goes, what do you want to do? I said, I want help. I said, if someone doesn't come over here right now, I'm going to drink these beers. And she raced over, she picked me up, she poured the beers out into the sink. She said, I had to go do a commitment at the high school. She's like, and this was prior to everybody having a cell phone, so it wasn't easy to get a hold of people back then. And she says, but I want you to come with me, and then I'm going to drop you off to these guys I know. I said, perfect. I'll do anything. I don't care. I didn't have time to shower. I still smelled from the night before. I have hair down to here. I just look like a fucking mess, you know. I'm permeating booze, you know. And she takes me to the high school, which was like Cherry Hill West, which is a very hoity-toity school. And she's talking to the cheerleading squad about alcoholism. And I'm standing in the corner, and they're like, well, what happens when you drink too much? And she's like, look at him. And I didn't care. I'm like, yes, I'm a fucking mess, man. And the meeting, that was over, and we went back to my house where a bunch of guys were going to meet us, and my buddy Ed, who I had been drinking with the night before, who had had like 10 months and went back out, and he's literally crawling from the bed to the bathroom to puke, just like, I don't want to live this life. I don't want to live this life anymore. And these guys took me and they, you know, a funny thing happens in Alcoholics Anonymous when you ask for help. It comes out of the woodwork. And it comes from all these people that when you're sitting in the back row and you're looking at and listening to these people, it comes from those people where you're going, this guy's an asshole, listen to him. This guy, Sean, who he was 21 years old, he lived at home with his mom, and he never wore shoes, and he was a huge, big guy, and he annoyed me the most because he always carried a big book with him at all times. He was always willing to quote something out of the big book at you. I guess his sponsor told him that he was in charge of me, and Sean would pick me up every morning, and he'd take me to a morning meeting, take me to an afternoon meeting. If he had to go do something, he'd drop me off to somebody else who would take me to like a dinner meeting, who would drop me back off to Sean, who would take me to like an 8 p.m. meeting, who would then take me to a midnight meeting. I spent my first 30 days sober at constant meetings in diners, you know. And this guy, Sean, who I couldn't stand, who always had that big book in his hand, and he had a car and I didn't, so it was very convenient, and I hung out with him a lot. And Sean knew everybody. I didn't like talking to people. I'd go into meetings, and I would sit there, and this is probably like my first 3 months, and I'd sit there and I'd look around, and you guys are laughing and having fun and slapping each other on the back and smiling and, you know, telling stories, and I'd sit there with my arms crossed, and you'd look at me, and I'd be like, what do you want? You know, what are you looking at? And I think to myself, these people are not like me. They're laughing, they're smiling, they're happy. I am a miserable motherfucker, man. And I kept comparing, and I kept comparing, and I kept comparing. And around 3 months sober, I'm sitting in a meeting, and Maple Shade meeting, and there's this guy there. And whenever he talked, I'd listen for some reason. I don't know why, because he was nothing like me. Because I only wanted to be around the dirty bikers or, like, you know, the street urchins and, you know, those are the only people I wanted to be around. And this guy was an insurance salesman, you know, and he was older than me by about 10, 15 years. And he was married, had kids, had a house, had a dog. He actually had, like, a white picket fence in front of his fucking house. And, like, but when he spoke at the meeting, he spoke about feeling alone, and he could be at a concert, in a room full of people, anything, and he never would feel so alone as he did at that moment, you know. He'd talk about feeling so uncomfortable in his own skin, you know, that he wanted to rip it off and he couldn't sit still. He'd talk about looking in the mirror at himself and just wanting to punch the mirror because he couldn't stand looking at himself. He'd talk about when he'd pick up that drink and it would hit his lips, and that craving, that obsession kicked in, you know? And he talked about, you know, something I understood, you know? He didn't talk about, you know, being on the streets, being shot at, you know, and telling that great story of, you know, going to jail for, you know, 72 hours. And he didn't talk about that stuff when he spoke. He talked about, you know, things I could relate to. You know, that he I remember he said one time, he goes, I was at a Christmas party with my family, he goes, and I hated Christmas. He goes, everybody else would start drinking, and I couldn't, because if I started, I wasn't going to stop. He goes, so I would sit in that room with my family, my mother and everybody else, and they're all drinking, and I'm just getting madder and madder, and I'm like, yes, I know that. I know that feeling. I know that feeling that if I picked up that drink in front of everybody, I was going to go nuts, even though they were all drinking, and I was fucking jealous, and I understood that, you know? I understood that obsession of that drink, that once that first one got in me, I'm thinking about the second, third, fourth, fifth one. I understood that, you know? I went up to Bob after a meeting, and I said to him, I was like, Bob, I need a sponsor. He goes, I know. I had hair down to here, I wore ripped jeans, and I played bass in a band, and I was a mess, and I was a street kid, and I didn't have a high school diploma, and this guy had a college degree, and Bob was the only one I understood. Bob would sit down with me and read the big book with me, and he bought me a dictionary, and a highlighter and a pen, and he said, we are going to dissect this big book. And Bob sat down with me, and we dissected the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he'd say, you know what that word means? Of course I know what that word means. What's it mean? I don't know. You know? And we'd look it up in the dictionary. And I'd write it next to it in a little part by the big book, and I'd write it in there, and I'd underline it. And we start working steps together, you know. He explained to me, you know, being powerless over alcohol, you know, the first step, and my life being unmanageable, you know. And I had to say, I manage, I get by. And he's like, did you ever eat out of a dumpster? I go, yeah. He goes, yeah, that's unmanageable, brother. We got to the second step, and I had a real bad problem with God. And my mother is Jewish, my father's Catholic, and they were not religious people. And the fight between my grandparents about how they're going to raise us, and I wasn't a religious guy, you know. And I had trouble with the second step. And Bob said to me, he goes, listen, he goes, if you can't get anything, do you think that Alcoholics Anonymous is greater than you? I said, well, yeah, I absolutely do. He goes, well, why don't you roll with that for a while? You know, and I did. It was wonderful. And I got to the third step, and And the third step was funny because, you know, I read it and I'm like, oh, I got this, I got this. He goes, you don't have this. You know, he goes, do you understand what selfishness and self-centeredness is? You know, and I didn't, you know. And he made me do a funny thing. He made me rewrite in the big book as the third step, you know, where it says, you know, we, you know, wherever it said we, I had to put I. And I rewrote all that and I made a better, I had a better understanding of what the third step meant. You know, how I was selfish, how I was self-centered, you know, how I stepped on people's toes and they retaliated. You know, I understood a little bit better that way. I got to the fourth step and we started writing and he said to me, he goes, you got 2 weeks. And he put a time on it, you know. And at 1 week and 6 days, I sat down and I did my fourth step and we sat down, we did a fifth step, we did a prayer afterwards and I did everything that the book said to do. You know, I went home and I meditated for an hour and I looked back at the first four steps to see if I had skipped anything and I didn't. And I was like, all right, cool. And I got to the fifth step and I got to my first amends. My first amends with my grandmother and I was petrified and I did it. And I remember walking out of the house after doing this fifth step with my grandmother and that weight coming off of me. And it was the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous that I thought that this is actually working. You know, this is actually starting to come true. These little promises, and he showed me, you know, that there was more promises than just the 9-step promises, you know, and he pointed these out to me, and I felt a weight lifted, and I thought, I'm going to go at this, you know, and I did. I went at it, and I got to the 6th step, and I got to see what all my defects of character were, and I had to trust God to remove these, and I got to my, I mean, by the time I got to my 9th step, you know, and all this, you know, and I guess, like I said, I'm making amends, and I'm feeling better, but I get to the 10th step work, and he wants me to write every night, and, you know, every day, and I'm doing my 11th step, and he's making me do it out of the step book, the St. Francis Assisi prayer. He wants me to say it every morning, and I'd love to tell you that I did all these, like, sure, Bob, I'm going at it, you know, but most of it came down to, well, I don't want to do this. You know, and I, when the pain got great enough, I started doing these things. You know, I got to that 12 step, and I took on a sponsee. I was probably, by the time I got all this done, I was like a year and a half sober, and I hooked up a sponsee. Let me go back. At a year sober. In New Jersey, what they do a lot is you stand up in front of your home group and your sponsor says a few funny things about you and then you tell about, you know, your 1 year, you know, and I'm listening to this girl who's ahead of me and I'm standing with my sponsor and she's talking about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracle of this and the miracle of that, and I'm getting pissed off, you know, and I'm like, I turn to him and I go, so when do I get my miracle? He goes, how long you been sober? I said, a year. He goes, shut the fuck up. And I went, that is a miracle, ain't it? You know? It's funny. And I got sober in a place where, you know, they told you, sit down, shut the hell up. You know, nothing about sobriety. Don't try to speak about it. When we want to know about drinking, we'll talk to you. You know? And I needed that. You know? And that's the kind of sobriety I got. That guy, Sean, by the way, the one I hated, who always showed up at my house with the big book, you know, the one that would break into my house when I wouldn't answer the door, you know, and wake me up and take me to a meeting, I was best man in his wedding, you know. 20 years later, and I still talk to this guy once a week, you know. He lives in Jersey, I'm out here in California, but we still talk once a week. You know, and the bonds that you make in Alcoholics Anonymous, you never know who's going to be, you know. If you're sitting in the back room and you're listening to me going, oh, if this guy says one more damn thing about the big book, you know, we might be best friends one day, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous for what it has done to me. It's taught me to be selfless. You know, it goes against the very grain of my nature because I am a very selfish human being. But it's taught me to be selfless. It's taught me that the joy I can get from helping others. You know, I have a sponsor. I still work with him. I got divorced 2 years ago. and he made me sit down and do a thorough four-step. And I remember saying to him, I'm 18 years sober, what am I doing here? You know, I'm not a newcomer, and he said, sit down and do it. And I sat down at 18 years sober, and I did a thorough four-step. You know, and I got to see my part and everything that was going on in my life. And it was absolutely wonderful, you know. I got sponsees. Tonight, I got to leave here right afterwards because I got to get back to L.A. because every Sunday night at 6 o'clock, I meet one of my sponsees at a coffee shop. And tonight, we're going to go over to Third Step, you know. And this is what I do, you know. Sometimes I do it begrudgingly because I'd rather sit on the sofa and watch a little TV, you know. But I don't want to go back to that life. I don't want to be sitting in Albuquerque, New Mexico in a bathroom stall puking my guts up, man, thinking, does it get any worse than this? You know, I've had some great joys in sobriety. I see all my children today. I have three kids, and 24, 23, and 21 now. I have four grandkids, and I get to see them. I raised my middle child, you know, when I was 5 years sober, I got custody of her. I'm a single father. And I raised my middle child by myself. The joys I have gotten out of being sober outweigh any joys I ever had while using. You know, if you're sitting in this room and you're hurting, you know, and you've got a sponsor and you're not reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with your sponsor, then you really don't have a sponsor. You know, I suggest you get a sponsor, or you go to your sponsor and say, let's start reading. You know, because, you know, it's a wonderful life. You know, I was 23 years old when I got sober. I was considered very young at that time period. You know, and I'm 43 now. And I'm sitting here last night, and I'm looking at the woman who had 60 years. And I'm thinking, she was 31. I'm thinking, man, you know, I hope I live that long. You know, I hope I live that long and stay sober that long. You know, I hope I don't walk away from Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope there's a day I can hand that newcomer a big book up on a stage, you know? Because how cool would that be, man? How cool do you think she felt last night, man? 60-some years sober being able to do that, man. It's absolutely wonderful. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I love everything it has done for me. You know, I'm glad you all came here on Sunday morning because I know most of you are probably up till 2 a.m. You know, and some of you might not even gone to sleep yet, but I really appreciate it. I appreciate everybody being here. Thank you.
All right, let's thank Mike again for coming out this morning and sharing.